4:40 a.m. on May 18, 1980, with the force of an atomic bomb. The entire lake disappeared under the massive lava flow, burying Truman and his cats and his home with it. In the aftermath, he became an icon. The old man who had stayed in his house, taken his chances, and lived life on his own terms in an era when that possibility seemed to have all but disappeared. The people of nearby Castle Rock constructed a memorial to him at the town's entrance that still stands, and there was a television movie starring Art Carney. Alice wasn't facing a volcano, but she might as well have been. Giving up her home on Greencastle Street meant giving up the life she had built for herself over decades. The things that made Longwood House so much safer and more manageable than the house were precisely what made it hard for her to endure. Her apartment might have been called independent living, but it involved the imposition of more structure and supervision than she'd ever had to deal with before. Aides watched her diet. Nurses monitored her health. They observed her growing unsteadiness and made her use a walker. This was reassuring for Alice's children, but she didn't like being nannied or controlled. And the regulation of her life only increased with time. When the staff became concerned that she was missing doses of her medications, they informed her that unless she kept her medications with the nurses and came down to their station twice a day to take them under direct supervision, she would have to move out of independent living to the nursing home wing. Jim and Nan hired a part-time aide named Mary to help Alice comply, to give her some company, and to stave off the day she would have to transfer. She liked Mary, but having her hanging around the apartment for hours on end, often with little to do, only made the situation more depressing. For Alice, it must have felt as if she had crossed into an alien land that she would never be allowed to leave. The border guards were friendly and cheerful enough. They promised her a nice place to live where she'd be well taken care of. But she didn't really want anyone to take care of her. She just wanted to live a life of her own. And those cheerful border guards had taken her keys and her passport. With her home went her control. People saw Harry Truman as a hero. There was never going to be a Longwood House for Harry Truman of Spirit Lake, and Alice Hobson of Arlington, Virginia, didn't want there to be one for her either. How did we wind up in a world where the only choices for the very old seemed to be either going down with a volcano or yielding all control over our lives? To understand what happened, you have to trace the story of how we replaced the poorhouse with the kinds of places we have today, and it turns out to be a medical story. Our old age homes didn't develop out of a desire to give the frail elderly better lives than they'd had in those dismal places. We didn't look around and say to ourselves, you know, there's this phase of people's lives in which they can't really cope on their own, and we ought to find a way to make it manageable. No, instead we said, this looks like a medical problem. Let's put these people in the hospital. Maybe the doctors can figure something out. The modern nursing home developed from there, more or less by accident. In the middle part of the 20th century, medicine was undergoing a rapid and historic transformation. Before that time, if you fell seriously ill, doctors usually tended to you in your own bed. The function of hospitals was mainly custodial. As the great physician-writer Lewis Thomas observed, describing his internship at Boston City Hospital in 1937, if being in a hospital bed made a difference, it was mostly the difference produced by warmth, shelter, and food, and attentive, friendly care, and the matchless skill of the nurses in providing these things. Whether you survived or not depended on the natural history of the disease itself. Medicine made little or no difference. From World War II onward, the picture shifted radically. Sulfa, penicillin, and then numerous other antibiotics became available for treating infections. Drugs to control blood pressure and treat hormonal imbalances were discovered. Breakthroughs in everything from heart surgery to artificial respirators to kidney transplantation became commonplace. Doctors became heroes, and the hospital transformed from a symbol of sickness and despondency to a place of hope and cure. Communities could not build hospitals fast enough. In America in 1946, Congress passed the Hill-Burton Act, which provided massive amounts of government funds for hospital construction. 2 decades later, the program had financed more than 9,000 new medical facilities across the country. For the first time, most people had a hospital nearby, and this became true across the industrialized world. The magnitude of this transformation is impossible to overstate. For most of our species' existence, people were fundamentally on their own with the sufferings of their body. They depended on nature and chance and the ministry of family and religion. Medicine was just another tool you could try, no different from a healing ritual or a family remedy, and no more effective. But as medicine became more powerful, the modern hospital brought a different idea. Here was a place where you could go saying, "Cure me." You checked in and gave over every part of your life to doctors and nurses, what you wore, what you ate, what went into the different parts of your body, and when. It wasn't always pleasant, but for a rapidly expanding range of problems, it produced unprecedented results. Hospitals learned how to eliminate infections, remove cancerous tumors, reconstruct shattered bones. They could fix hernias and heart valves and hemorrhaging stomach ulcers. They became the normal place for people to go with their bodily troubles, including the elderly. Meanwhile, policy planners had assumed that establishing a pension system would end poorhouses, but the problem did not go away. In America, in the years following the passage of the Social Security Act of 1935, the number of elderly in poorhouses refused to drop. States moved to close them, but found they could not. The reason old people wound up in poorhouses, it turned out, was not just that they didn't have the money to pay for a home. They were there because they'd become too frail, sick, feeble, senile, or broken down to take care of themselves anymore, and they had nowhere else to turn for help. Pensions provided a way of allowing the elderly to manage independently as long as possible in their retirement years, but pensions hadn't provided a plan for that final, infirm stage of mortal life. As hospitals sprang up, they became a comparatively more attractive place to put the infirm. That was finally what brought the poorhouses to empty out. One by one through the 1950s, the poorhouses closed. Responsibility for those who'd been classified as elderly paupers was transferred to departments of welfare, and the sick and disabled were put in hospitals. But hospitals couldn't solve the debilities of chronic illness and advancing age, and they began to fill up with people who had nowhere to go. The hospitals lobbied the government for help, and in 1954, lawmakers provided funding to enable them to build separate custodial units for patients needing an extended period of recovery. That was the beginning of the modern nursing home. They were never created to help people facing dependency in old age. They were created to clear out hospital beds, which is why they were called nursing homes. This has been the persistent pattern of how modern society has dealt with old age. The systems we've devised were almost always designed to solve some other problem. As one scholar put it, describing the history of nursing homes from the perspective of the elderly, is like describing the opening of the American West from the perspective of the mules. They were certainly there, and the epical events were certainly critical to the mules, but hardly anyone was paying very much attention to them at the time. The next major spur to American nursing home growth was similarly unintentional. When Medicare, America's health insurance system for the aged and disabled, passed in 1965, the law specified that it would pay only for care in facilities that met basic health and safety standards. A significant number of hospitals, especially in the South, couldn't meet those standards. Policymakers feared a major backlash from elderly patients with Medicare cards being turned away from their local hospital. So the Bureau of Health Insurance invented the concept of substantial compliance. If the hospital came close to meeting the standards and aimed to improve, it would be approved. The category was a complete fabrication with no legal basis, though it solved a problem without major harm. Virtually all of the hospitals did improve. But the Bureau's ruling gave an opening to nursing homes, few of which met even minimum federal standards, such as having a nurse on site or fire protections in place. Thousands of them, asserting that they were in substantial compliance, were approved, and the number of nursing homes exploded. By 1970, some 13,000 of them had been built, and so did reports of neglect and mistreatment. That year, in Marietta, Ohio, the next county over from my hometown, a nursing home fire trapped and killed 32 residents. In Baltimore, a salmonella epidemic in a nursing home claimed 36 lives. With time, regulations were tightened. The health and safety problems were finally addressed. Nursing homes are no longer fire traps, but the core problem persists. This place, where half of us will typically spend a year or more of our lives, was never truly made for us. One morning, Alice had a fall while alone in her apartment. She wasn't found until many hours later when Nan, who was puzzled at not being able to reach her by phone, sent Jim to investigate. He discovered Alice laid out beside the living room couch, nearly unconscious. At the hospital, the medical team gave her intravenous fluids and a series of tests and x-rays. They found no broken bones or head injury. Everything seemed okay. But they also found no explanation for her fall beyond general frailty. When she returned to Longwood House, she was encouraged to move to the skilled nursing floor. She resisted vehemently. She did not want to go. The staff relented. They checked her more frequently. Mary increased the hours she spent looking after her, but before long, Jim got a call that Alice had fallen again. It was a bad fall, they said. She'd been taken by ambulance to a hospital. By the time he got there, she had already been wheeled into surgery. X-rays showed she'd broken her hip. The top of her femur had snapped like a glass stem. The orthopedic surgeons repaired the fracture with a couple of long metal nails. This time, she came back to Longwood House in a wheelchair and needed help with virtually all of her everyday activities, using the toilet, bathing, dressing. Alice was left with no choice but to move into the skilled nursing unit. The hope, they told her, was that with physical therapy, she'd learn to walk again and return to her apartment. But she never did. From then on, she was confined to a wheelchair, and the rigidity of nursing home life. All privacy and control were gone. She was put in hospital clothes most of the time. She woke when they told her, bathed and dressed when they told her, ate when they told her. She lived with whomever they said she had to. There was a succession of roommates, never chosen with her input, and all with cognitive impairments. Some were quiet. One kept her up at night. She felt incarcerated, like she was in prison for being old. The sociologist Irving Goffman noted the likeness between prisons and nursing homes half a century ago in his book, Asylums. They were, along with military training camps, orphanages, and mental hospitals, total institutions, places largely cut off from wider society. A basic social arrangement in modern society is that the individual tends to sleep, play, and work in different places, with different co-participants, under different authorities, and without an overall rational plan, he wrote. By contrast, total institutions break down the barriers separating our spheres of life in specific ways that he enumerated. First, all aspects of life are conducted in the same place and under the same central authority. Second, each phase of the member's daily activity is carried on in the immediate company of a large batch of others, all of whom are treated alike and required to do the same thing together. Third, all phases of the day's activities are tightly scheduled, with one activity leading at a prearranged time into the next, the whole sequence of activities being imposed from above by a system of explicit formal rulings and a body of officials. Finally, the various enforced activities are brought together into a single plan purportedly designed to fulfill the official aims of the institution. In a nursing home, the official aim of the institution is caring, but the idea of caring that had evolved didn't bear any meaningful resemblance to what Alice would call living. She was hardly alone in feeling this way. I once met an 89-year-old woman who had, of her own volition, checked herself into a Boston nursing home. Usually, it's the children who push for a change, but in this case, she was the one who did. She had congestive heart failure, disabling arthritis, and after a series of falls, she felt she had little choice but to leave her condominium in Delray Beach, Florida. "I fell twice in 1 week, and I told my daughter I don't belong at home anymore," she said. She picked the facility herself. It had excellent ratings and nice staff, and her daughter lived nearby. She had moved in the month before I met her. She told me she was glad to be in a safe place. If there's anything a decent nursing home is built for, it is safety. But she was wretchedly unhappy. The trouble was that she expected more from life than safety. "I know I can't do what I used to," she said, "but this feels like a hospital, not a home." It is a near universal reality. Nursing home priorities are matters like avoiding bed sores and maintaining residents' weight, important medical goals to be sure, but they are means, not ends. The woman had left an airy apartment she furnished herself for a small beige hospital-like room with a stranger for a roommate. Her belongings were stripped down to what she could fit into the one cupboard and shelf they gave her. Basic matters like when she went to bed, woke up, dressed, and ate were subject to the rigid schedule of institutional life. She couldn't have her own furniture or a cocktail before dinner because it wasn't safe. There was so much more she felt she could do in her life. "I want to be helpful, play a role," she said. She used to make her own jewelry, volunteer at the library. Now her main activities were bingo, DVD movies, and other forms of passive group entertainment. The things she missed most, she told me, were her friendships, privacy, and a purpose to her days. Nursing homes have come a long way from the fire-trap warehouses of neglect they used to be, but it seems we've succumbed to a belief that once you lose your physical independence, a life of worth and freedom is simply not possible. The elderly themselves have not completely succumbed, however. Many resist. In every nursing home and assisted living facility, battles rage over the priorities and values people are supposed to live by. Some, like Alice, resist mainly through non-cooperation, refusing the scheduled activities or medications. They are the ones we call feisty. It's a favorite word for the aged. Outside a nursing home, we usually apply the adjective with a degree of admiration. We like the tenacious, sometimes cantankerous ways in which the Harry Trumans of the world assert themselves. But inside, when we say someone is feisty, we mean it in a less complimentary way. Nursing home staff like and approve of residents who are fighters and show dignity and self-esteem, until these traits interfere with the staff's priorities for them. Then they are feisty. Talk to the staff members and you will hear about the daily skirmishes. A woman calls for help to the bathroom every 5 minutes, so they put her on a set schedule, taking her to the bathroom once every couple hours when it fits into their rounds. But she doesn't go according to schedule, instead wetting her bed 10 minutes after a bathroom trip. So now they put her in a diaper. Another resident refuses to use his walker and takes unauthorized, unaccompanied walks. A third sneaks cigarettes and alcohol. Food is the Hundred Years' War. A woman with severe Parkinson's disease keeps violating her pureed diet restriction, stealing food from other residents that could cause her to choke. A man with Alzheimer's disease hoards snacks in his room, violating house rules. A diabetic is found eating clandestine sugar cookies and pudding, knocking his blood sugar levels off his target. Who knew you could rebel just by eating a cookie? In the horrible places, the battle for control escalates until you get tied down, or locked into your Jerry chair, or chemically subdued with psychotropic medications. In the nice ones, a staff member cracks a joke, wags an affectionate finger, and takes your brownie stash away. In almost none, does anyone sit down with you and try to figure out what living a life really means to you under the circumstances, let alone help you make a home where that life becomes possible. This is the consequence of a society that faces the final phase of the human life cycle by trying not to think about it. We end up with institutions that address any number of societal goals, from freeing up hospital beds to taking burdens off families' hands to coping with poverty among the elderly, but never the goal that matters to the people who reside in them. How to make life worth living when we're weak and frail and can't fend for ourselves anymore. One day when Jim visited Alice, she whispered something in his ear. It was winter, 1994. A few weeks after her hip fracture and admission to the skilled nursing unit, and 2 years since she'd begun living at Longwood House. He'd wheeled her from her room for a stroll around the complex. They found a comfortable place in the lobby and stopped to sit for a while. They were both quiet people, and they'd been content to sit there silently, watching people come and go. That was when she leaned toward him in her wheelchair. She whispered just 2 words. "I'm ready," she said. He looked at her. She looked at him. And he understood. She was ready to die. "Okay, Mom," Jim said. It saddened him. He wasn't sure what to do about it, but not long afterward, the two of them arranged for a do-not-resuscitate order to be put on record at the nursing home. If her heart or her breathing stopped, they would not attempt to rescue her from death. They would not do chest compressions or shock her or put a breathing tube down her throat. They would let her go. Months passed. She waited and endured. One April night, she developed abdominal pains. She mentioned them briefly to a nurse, then decided to say nothing more. Later, she vomited blood. She alerted no one. She didn't press the call button or say anything to her roommate. She stayed in bed, silent. The next morning, when the aides came to wake the residents on her floor, they found she was gone. 4. Assistance. You'd think people would have rebelled. You'd think we would have burned the nursing homes to the ground. We haven't, though, because we find it hard to believe that anything better is possible for when we are so weakened and frail that managing without help is no longer feasible. We haven't had the imagination for it. In the main, the family has remained the primary alternative. Your chances of avoiding the nursing home are directly related to the number of children you have, and according to what little research has been done, having at least one daughter seems to be crucial to the amount of help you will receive. But our greater longevity has coincided with the increased dependence of families on dual incomes, with results that are painful and unhappy for all involved. Lou Sanders was 88 years old when he and his daughter Shelley were confronted with a difficult decision about the future. Up to that point, he had managed well. He'd never demanded much from life beyond a few modest pleasures and the company of family and friends. The son of Russian-speaking Jewish immigrants from Ukraine, he'd grown up in Dorchester, a working-class neighborhood in Boston. In World War II, he served in the Air Force in the South Pacific, and after returning, he married and settled in Lawrence, an industrial town outside Boston. He and his wife Ruth had a son and a daughter, and he went into the appliance business with a brother-in-law. Lou was able to buy the family a 3-bedroom house in a nice neighborhood and give his children college educations. He and Ruth encountered their share of life's troubles. Their son, for instance, had serious problems with drugs, alcohol, and money, and proved to have bipolar disorder. In his 40s, he committed suicide. and the appliance business, which had done well for years, went belly up when the chain stores came along. At 50 years old, Lou found himself having to start over. Nonetheless, despite his age, lack of experience, and lack of a college education, he was given a new chance as an electronic technician at Raytheon and ended up spending the remainder of his career there. He retired at 67, having worked the additional 2 years to get 3% extra on his Raytheon pension. Meanwhile, Ruth developed health issues. A lifelong smoker, she was diagnosed with lung cancer, survived it, and kept smoking, which Lou couldn't understand. 3 years after Lou retired, she had a stroke that she never wholly recovered from. She became increasingly dependent on him for transportation, for shopping, for managing the house, for everything. Then she developed a lump under her arm, and a biopsy revealed metastatic cancer. She died in October 1994 at the age of 73. Lou, at 76, became a widower. Shelley worried for him. She didn't know how he would get along without Ruth. Caring for Ruth through her decline, however, had forced him to learn to fend for himself, and although he mourned, he gradually found that he didn't mind being on his own. For the next decade, he led a happy, satisfying life. He had a simple routine. He rose early in the morning, fixed himself breakfast, and read the newspaper. He'd take a walk, buy his groceries for the day at the supermarket, and come home to make his lunch. Later in the afternoon, he would go to the town library. It was pretty, light-filled, and quiet, and he'd spend a couple hours reading his favorite magazines and newspapers or burrowing into a thriller. Returning home, he'd read a book he'd checked out, or watch a movie, or listen to music. A couple of nights a week, he'd play cribbage with one of his neighbors in the building. "My father developed really interesting friendships," Shelley said. "He could make friends with anyone." One of Lou's new companions was an Iranian clerk at a video store in town where Lou often stopped in. The clerk, named Bob, was in his 20s. Lou would perch on a bar stool that Bob set up by the counter for him, and the two of them, the young Iranian and the old Jew, could hang out for hours. They became such good pals that they even traveled to Las Vegas together once. Lou loved going to casinos and made trips with an assortment of friends. Then, in 2003, at the age of 85, he had a heart attack. He proved lucky. An ambulance sped him to the hospital, and the doctors were able to stent open his blocked coronary artery in time. After a couple weeks in a cardiac rehabilitation center, it was as if nothing had happened at all. 3 years later, however, he had his first fall, that harbinger of unstoppable trouble. Shelley noticed that he had developed a tremor, and a neurologist diagnosed him with Parkinson's disease. Medications controlled the symptoms, but he also began having trouble with his memory. Shelley observed that when he told a long story, he sometimes lost the thread of what he was saying. Other times, he seemed confused about something they'd just spoken about. Most of the time, he seemed fine, even exceptional for a man of 88 years. He still drove. He still beat everyone at cribbage. He still looked after his home and managed his finances by himself. But then he had another bad fall, and it scared him. He suddenly felt the weight of all the changes that had been accumulating. He told Shelley he was afraid he might fall one day, hit his head, and die. It wasn't dying that scared him, he said, but the possibility of dying alone. She asked him what he would think about looking at retirement homes. He wanted no part of it. He'd seen friends in those sorts of places. "They're full of old people," he said. It was not the way he wanted to live. He made Shelley promise to never put him in such a place. Still, he could no longer manage on his own. The only choice left for him was to move in with her and her family. So that's what Shelley arranged for him to do. I asked her and her husband Tom how they had felt about this. "Good," they both said. "I didn't feel comfortable with him living independently anymore," Shelley said, and Tom agreed. Lude had a heart attack. He was going on 90. This was the least they could do for him, and they admitted thinking, how long were they really going to have with him anyway? Tom and Shelley lived comfortably in a modest colonial in North Reading, a Boston suburb, but never completely so. Shelley worked as a personal assistant. Tom had just spent a year and a half unemployed after a layoff. Now he worked for a travel company for less than he used to earn. With two teenage children in the house, there was no obvious space for Lou, but Shelley and Tom converted their living room into a bedroom, moving in a bed, an easy chair, Lou's armoire, and a flat-screen television. The rest of his furniture was sold off or put in storage. Cohabitation required adjustment. Everyone soon discovered the reasons that generations prefer living apart. Parent and child traded roles, and Lou didn't like not being the master of his home. He also found himself lonelier than he expected. On their suburban cul-de-sac, he had no company for long stretches of the day, and nowhere nearby to walk to, no library or video store or supermarket. Shelley tried to get him involved in a day program for senior citizens. She took him to a breakfast they had. He didn't like it one bit. She discovered they made occasional trips to Foxwoods, a casino 2 hours from Boston. It wasn't his favorite, but he agreed to go. She was thrilled. She hoped he'd make friends. She told me, "It felt like I was putting my child on the bus," which was probably exactly what he disliked about it. I remember saying, "Hi, everyone, this is Lou. This is his first time, so I hope you'll all be friends with him." When he came back, she asked him if he'd made any friends. "No," he said. "He just gambled by himself." Gradually, though, he found ways to adapt. Shelley and Tom had a Chinese Shar-Pei named Beijing, and Lou and the dog became devoted companions. She slept on his bed with him at night and sat with him when he read or watched TV. He took her on walks. If she was in his recliner, he'd go get another chair from the kitchen rather than disturb her. He found human companions, too. He took to greeting the mailman each day, and they became friends. The mailman played cribbage, and he started coming over every Monday to play on his lunch hour. Shelley hired a young man named Dave to spend time with Lou as well. It was the sort of pre-engineered play date that is always doomed to failure, but, go figure, they hit it off. Lou played cribbage with Dave, too, and he came over a couple afternoons a week to hang out. Lou settled in and imagined that this would be how he'd live out the rest of his days. But while he managed to adjust, Shelley found the situation steadily more impossible. She was working, looking after the home, and worrying about her kids, who had their own struggles as they made their way through high school. And then she had to look after her dear but frighteningly frail and dependent father. It was an enormous burden. The falls, for example, never stopped. He'd be in his room or in the bathroom or getting up from the kitchen table when he'd suddenly pitch off his feet like a tree falling. In 1 year, he had 4 ambulance rides to the emergency room. The doctors stopped his Parkinson's medication, thinking that might be the culprit, but that only worsened his tremors and made him yet more unsteady on his feet. Eventually, he was diagnosed with postural hypotension, a condition of old age in which the body loses its ability to maintain adequate blood pressure for brain function during changes in position like standing up from sitting. The only thing the doctors could do was to tell Shelley to be more careful with him. At night, she discovered, Lou had night terrors. He dreamt of war. He'd never been in hand-to-hand combat, but in his dreams, an enemy would be attacking him with a sword, stabbing him, or chopping his arm off. They were vivid and terrifying. He'd thrash and shout and hit the wall next to him. The family could hear him across the house. "No! What do you mean? You son of a bitch!" "We'd never heard him say anything like that before," Shelley said. He kept the family up many nights. The demands on Shelley only mounted. At 90, Lou no longer had the balance and dexterity required to bathe himself. On the advice of a senior services program, Shelley installed bathroom grab bars, a sitting-height toilet, and a shower chair, but they weren't enough, so she arranged for a home health aide to help with washing and other tasks. But Lou didn't want showers in the daytime when an aide could help. He wanted baths in the nighttime, which required Shelley's help. So every day, this became her job, too. It was the same with changing his clothes when he had wet himself. He had prostate issues, and although the urologist gave him medicines for it, he still had problems with dribbles and leaks and not making it to the bathroom in time. Shelley tried to get him to wear protective disposable underwear, but he wouldn't do it. "They're diapers," he said. The burdens were large and small. He didn't like the food she made for the rest of her family. He never complained, he just wouldn't eat. So she had to start making separate meals for him. He was hard of hearing and would blast the television in his room at brain-broiling volume. They'd shut his door, but he didn't like that. The dog couldn't get in and out. Shelley was ready to throttle him. Eventually, she found wireless earbuds called TV ears. Lou hated them, but she made him use them. "They were a lifesaver," Shelley said. I wasn't sure if she meant that it was her life that they saved or his. Taking care of a debilitated elderly person in our medicalized era is an overwhelming combination of the technological and the custodial. Lou was on numerous medications, which had to be tracked and sorted and refilled. He had a small platoon of specialists he had to visit, at times nearly weekly, and they were forever scheduling laboratory tests, imaging studies, and visits to other specialists. He had an electronic alert system for falls, which had to be tested monthly, and there was almost no help for Shelley. The burdens for today's caregiver have actually increased from what they would have been a century ago. Shelley had become a round-the-clock concierge, chauffeur, schedule manager, medication and technology troubleshooter, in addition to cook, maid, attendant, not to mention income earner. Last-minute cancellations by health aides and changes in medical appointments played havoc with her performance at work, and everything played havoc with her emotions at home. Just to take an overnight trip with her family, she had to hire someone to stay with Lou, and even then, a crisis would scuttle the plans. One time, she went on a Caribbean vacation with her husband and kids, but had to return after just 3 days. Lou needed her. She felt her sanity slipping. She wanted to be a good daughter. She wanted her father to be safe, and she wanted him to be happy. But she wanted a manageable life, too. One night she asked her husband, "Should we find a place for him?" She felt ashamed just voicing the thought. It'd break her promise to her father. Tom wasn't much help. "You'll manage," he told her. "How much more time is there?" "Lots," it would turn out. "I was being insensitive to her," Tom told me, looking back 3 years later. Shelley was reaching the breaking point. She had a cousin who ran an elder care organization. He recommended a nurse to come out to assess Lou and talk to him so that Shelley didn't have to be the bad guy. The nurse told Lou that given his increased needs, he needed more help than he could get at home. "He shouldn't be so alone through the day," she said. He looked at Shelley imploringly, and she knew what he was thinking. Couldn't she just stop working and be there for him? The question felt like a dagger in her chest. Shelley teared up and told him that she couldn't provide the care he needed, not emotionally and not financially. Reluctantly, he agreed to let her take him to look for a place. It seemed as if, once aging led to debility, it was impossible for anyone to be happy. The place they'd decided to visit wasn't a nursing home, but an assisted living facility. Today, assisted living is regarded as something of an intermediate station between independent living and life in a nursing home. But when Karen Brown Wilson, one of the originators of the concept, built her first assisted living home for the aged in Oregon in the 1980s, she was trying to create a place that would eliminate the need for nursing homes altogether. She'd wanted to build an alternative, not a halfway station. Wilson believed she could create a place where people like Lou Sanders could live with freedom and autonomy, no matter how physically limited they became. She thought that just because you are old and frail, you shouldn't have to submit to life in an asylum. In her head, she had a vision of how to make a better life achievable, and that vision had been formed by the same experiences of reluctant dependency and agonized responsibility that Lou and Shelley were grappling with. The bookish daughter of a West Virginia coal miner and a washerwoman, neither of whom were schooled past eighth grade, Wilson was an unlikely radical. When she was in grade school, her father died. Then, when she was 19 years old, her mother, Jessie, suffered a devastating stroke. Jessie was just 55 years old. The stroke left her permanently paralyzed down one side of her body. She could no longer walk or stand. She couldn't lift her arm. Her face sagged. Her speech slurred. Although her intelligence and perception were unaffected, she couldn't bathe herself, cook a meal, manage the toilet, or do her own laundry, let alone any kind of paid work. She needed help. But Wilson was just a college student. She had no income, a tiny apartment she shared with a roommate, and no way to take care of her mother. She had siblings, but they were little better equipped. There was nowhere for Jessie but a nursing home. Wilson arranged for one near where she was in college. It seemed a safe and friendly place. But Jessie never stopped asking her daughter to take me home. Get me out of here, she said over and over again. Wilson became interested in policy for the aged. When she graduated, she got a job working in senior services for the state of Washington. As the years passed, Jessie shifted through a series of nursing homes near one or another of her children. She didn't like a single one of those places. Meanwhile, Wilson got married, and her husband, a sociologist, encouraged her to continue with her schooling. She was accepted as a PhD student in gerontology at Portland State University in Oregon. When she told her mother she would be studying the science of aging, Jessie asked her a question that Wilson says changed her life. Why don't you do something to help people like me? Her vision was simple, Wilson wrote later. She wanted a small place with a little kitchen and a bathroom. It would have her favorite things in it, including her cat, her unfinished projects, her Vicks VapoRub, a coffee pot, and cigarettes. There would be people to help her with the things she couldn't do without help. In the imaginary place, she would be able to lock her door, control her heat, and have her own furniture. No one would make her get up, turn off her favorite soaps, or ruin her clothes. Nor could anyone throw out her collection of back issues and magazines and Goodwill treasures because they were a safety hazard. She could have privacy whenever she wanted, and no one could make her get dressed, take her medicine, or go to activities she did not like. She would be Jessie again, a person living in an apartment instead of a patient in a bed. Wilson didn't know what to do when her mother told her these things. Her mother's desires seemed both reasonable and, according to the rules of the places she'd lived, impossible. Wilson felt badly for the nursing home staff, who worked hard taking care of her mother and were just doing what they were expected to do, and she felt guilty that she couldn't do more herself. In graduate school, her mother's uncomfortable question nagged at her. The more she studied and probed, the more convinced she became that nursing homes would not accept anything like what Jessie envisioned. The institutions were designed in every detail for the control of their residents. The fact that this design was supposed to be for their health and safety, for their benefit, made the places only that much more benighted and impervious to change. Wilson decided to try spelling out on paper an alternative that would let frail, elderly people maintain as much control over their care as possible, instead of having to let their care control them. The key word in her mind was home. Home is the one place where your own priorities hold sway. At home, you decide how you spend your time. how you share your space, and how you manage your possessions. Away from home, you don't. This loss of freedom was what people like Lou Sanders and Wilson's mother Jessie dreaded. Wilson and her husband sat at their dining table and began sketching out the features of a new kind of home for the elderly, a place like the one her mother had pined for. Then they tried to get someone to build it and test whether it would work. They approached retirement communities and builders. None were interested. The ideas seemed impractical and absurd. So the couple decided to build the place on their own. They were two academics who had never attempted anything of the sort. But they learned one step at a time. They worked with an architect to lay out the plans in detail. They went to bank after bank to get a loan. When that did not succeed, they found a private investor who backed them but required them to give up majority ownership and to accept personal liability for failure. They signed the deal. Then the state of Oregon threatened to withhold licensing as senior housing because the plans stipulated that people with disabilities would be living there. Wilson spent several days camped out in one government office after another until she had secured an exemption. Unbelievably, she and her husband cleared every obstacle. And in 1983, their new living center with assistance for the elderly, named Park Place, opened in Portland. By the time it opened, Park Place had become far more than an academic pilot project. It was a major real estate development with 112 units, and they filled up almost immediately. The concept was as appealing as it was radical. Although some of the residents had profound disabilities, none were called patients. They were all simply tenants and were treated as such. They had private apartments with a full bath, kitchen, and a front door that locked, a touch many found particularly hard to imagine. They were allowed to have pets and to choose their own carpeting and furniture. They were given control over temperature settings, food, who came into their home, and when. They were just people living in an apartment, Wilson insisted over and over again. But as elders with advancing disabilities, they were also provided with the sorts of help that my grandfather found so readily with his family all around. There was help with the basics: food, personal care, medications. There was a nurse on site, and tenants had a button for summoning urgent assistance at any time of day or night. There was also help with maintaining a decent quality of life, having company, keeping up their connections in the outside world, continuing the activities they valued most. The services were, in most ways, identical to the services that nursing homes provide. But here, the care providers understood they were entering someone else's home, and that changed the power relations fundamentally. The residents had control over the schedule, the ground rules, the risks they did and didn't want to take. If they wanted to stay up all night and sleep all day, and if they wanted to have a gentleman or lady friend stay over, if they wanted not to take certain medications that made them feel groggy, if they wanted to eat pizza and M&Ms despite swallowing problems and no teeth and a doctor who'd said they should eat only pureed glop, well, they could. And if their mind had faded to the point that they could no longer make rational decisions, then their family, or whomever they'd designated, could help negotiate the terms of the risks and choices that were acceptable. With assisted living, as Wilson's concept became known, the goal was that no one ever had to feel institutionalized. The concept was attacked immediately. Many longtime advocates for the protection of the elderly saw the design as fundamentally dangerous. How was the staff going to keep people safe behind closed doors? How could people with physical disabilities and memory problems be permitted to have cooktops, cutting knives, alcohol, and the like? Who was going to ensure that the pets they chose were safe? How was the carpeting going to be sanitized and kept free of urine odors and bacteria? How would the staff know if a tenant's health condition had changed? These were legitimate questions. Is someone who refuses regular housekeeping, smokes cigarettes, and eats candies that cause a diabetic crisis, requiring a trip to the hospital, someone who is a victim of neglect, or an archetype of freedom. There is no clean dividing line, and Wilson was not offering simple answers. She held herself and her staff responsible for developing ways of ensuring the safety of the tenants. At the same time, her philosophy was to provide a place where residents retained the autonomy and privacy of people living in their own homes, including the right to refuse strictures imposed for reasons of safety or institutional convenience. The state monitored the experiment closely. When the group expanded to a second location in Portland, this one had 142 units and capacity for impoverished elderly people on government support, the state required Wilson and her husband to track the health, cognitive capabilities, physical function, and life satisfaction of the tenants. In 1988, the findings were made public. They revealed that the residents had not, in fact, traded their health for freedom. Their satisfaction with their lives increased, and at the same time, their health was maintained. Their physical and cognitive functioning actually improved. Incidence of major depression fell, and the cost of those on government support was 20% lower than it would have been in a nursing home. The program proved an unmitigated success. At the center of Wilson's work was an attempt to solve a deceptively simple puzzle. What makes life worth living when we are old and frail and unable to care for ourselves? In 1943, the psychologist Abraham Maslow published his hugely influential paper, A Theory of Human Motivation, which famously described people as having a hierarchy of needs. It is often depicted as a pyramid. At the bottom are our basic needs, the essentials of physiological survival, such as food, water, and air, and of safety, such as law, order, and stability. Up one level are the need for love and for belonging. Above that is our desire for growth, the opportunity to attain personal goals, to master knowledge and skills, and to be recognized and rewarded for our achievements. Finally, at the top is the desire for what Maslow termed self-actualization, self-fulfillment through pursuit of moral ideals and creativity for their own sake. Maslow argued that safety and survival remain our primary and foundational goals in life, not least when our options and capacities become limited. If true, the fact that public policy and concern about old age homes focus on health and safety is just a recognition and manifestation of those goals. They are assumed to be everyone's first priorities. Reality is more complex, though. People readily demonstrate a willingness to sacrifice their safety and survival for the sake of something beyond themselves, such as family, country, or justice. And this is regardless of age. What's more, our driving motivations in life, instead of remaining constant, change hugely over time and in ways that don't quite fit Maslow's classic hierarchy. In young adulthood, people seek a life of growth and self-fulfillment, just as Maslow suggested. Growing up involves opening outward. We search out new experiences, wider social connections, and ways of putting our stamp on the world. When people reach the latter half of adulthood, however, their priorities change markedly. Most reduce the amount of time and effort they spend pursuing achievement and social networks. They narrow in. Given the choice, young people prefer meeting new people to spending time with, say, a sibling. Old people prefer the opposite. Studies find that as people grow older, they interact with fewer people and concentrate more on spending time with family and established friends. They focus on being rather than doing, and on the present more than the future. Understanding this shift is essential to understanding old age. A variety of theories have attempted to explain why the shift occurs. Some have argued that it reflects wisdom gained from long experience in life. Others suggest it is the cognitive result of changes in the tissue of the aging brain. Still others argue that the behavior change is forced upon the elderly and does not actually reflect what they want in their heart of hearts. They narrow in because the constrictions of physical and cognitive decline prevent them from pursuing the goals they once had, or because the world stops them for no other reason than they are old. Rather than fight it, they adapt, or, to put it more sadly, they give in. Few researchers in recent decades have done more creative or important work sorting these arguments out than the Stanford psychologist Laura Carstensen. In one of her most influential studies, she and her team tracked the emotional experiences of nearly 200 people over years of their lives. The subjects spanned a broad range of backgrounds and ages. They were from 18 to 94 years old when they entered the study. At the beginning of the study, and then every 5 years, the subjects were given a beeper to carry around 24 hours a day for 1 week. They were randomly paged 35 times over the course of that week and asked to choose from a list all the emotions they were experiencing at that exact moment. If Maslow's hierarchy was right, then the narrowing of life runs against people's greatest sources of fulfillment, and you would expect people to grow unhappier as they age. But Carstensen's research found exactly the opposite. The results were unequivocal. Far from growing unhappier, people reported more positive emotions as they aged. They became less prone to anxiety, depression, and anger. They experienced trials, to be sure, and more moments of poignancy, that is, of positive and negative emotion mixed together. But overall, they found living to be a more emotionally satisfying and stable experience as time passed, even as old age narrowed the lives they led. The findings raised a further question. If we shift as we age toward appreciating everyday pleasures and relationships rather than toward achieving, having, and getting, and if we find this more fulfilling, then why do we take so long to do it? Why do we wait until we're old? The common view was that these lessons are hard to learn. Living is a kind of skill. The calm and wisdom of old age are achieved over time. Carstensen was attracted to a different explanation. What if the change in needs and desires has nothing to do with age, per se? Suppose it merely has to do with perspective, your personal sense of how finite your time in this world is. This idea was regarded in scientific circles as somewhat odd, but Carstensen had her own reason for thinking that one's personal perspective might be centrally important, a near-death experience that radically changed her point of view on her own life. It was 1974. She was 21, with an infant at home and a marriage already in divorce proceedings. She had only a high school education and a life that no one, least of all her, would have predicted might someday lead to an eminent scientific career. But one night, she left the baby with her parents and went out with friends to party and see the band Hot Tuna in concert. Coming back from the show, they piled into a VW minibus and, on a highway somewhere outside Rochester, New York, the driver, drunk, rolled the minibus over an embankment. Carstensen barely survived. She had a serious head injury, internal bleeding, multiple shattered bones. She spent months in the hospital. "It was that cartoonish scene, lying on my back, leg tied in the air," she told me. "I had a lot of time to think after the initial 3 weeks or so when things were really touch and go and I was coming in and out of consciousness. I got better enough to realize how close I had come to losing my life, and I saw very differently what mattered to me. What mattered were other people in my life. I was 21. Every thought I'd had before that was, what was I going to do next in life? And how would I become successful or not successful? Would I find the perfect soulmate? Lots of questions like that which I think are typical of 21-year-olds. All of a sudden, it was like I was stopped dead in the tracks. When I looked at what seemed important to me, very different things mattered. She didn't instantly recognize how parallel her new perspective was to the one old people commonly have. But the four other patients in her ward were all elderly women, their legs strung up in the air after hip fractures, and Carstensen found herself connecting with them. "I was lying there surrounded by old people," she said. "I got to know them, see what was happening to them." She noticed how differently they were treated from her. "I basically had doctors and therapists coming in and working with me all day long, and they would sort of wave at Sadie, the lady in the next bed, on the way out, and say, 'Keep up the good work, hon.' The message was, this young woman's life had possibilities. Theirs didn't." "It was this experience that led me to study aging," Carstensen said. But she didn't know at the time that it would. "I was not on a trajectory to end up being a professor at Stanford by any means at that point in my life." Her father, however, realized how bored she was lying there and took the opportunity to enroll her in a course at a local college. He went to all the lectures, audiotaped them, and brought the cassettes to her. She ended up taking her first college course in a hospital on a women's orthopedics ward. What was that first class, by the way? Introduction to Psychology. Lying there on that ward, she found she was living through the phenomena she was studying. Right from the start, she could see what the experts were getting right and what they were getting wrong. 15 years later, when she was a scholar, the experience led her to formulate a hypothesis. How we seek to spend our time may depend on how much time we perceive ourselves to have. When you are young and healthy, you believe you will live forever. You do not worry about losing any of your capabilities. People tell you the world is your oyster, the sky is the limit, and so on. And you are willing to delay gratification, to invest years, for example, in gaining skills and resources for a brighter future. You seek to plug into bigger streams of knowledge and information. You widen your networks of friends and connections instead of hanging out with your mother. When horizons are measured in decades, which might as well be infinity to human beings, you most desire all that stuff at the top of Maslow's pyramid, achievement, creativity, and other attributes of self-actualization. But as your horizons contract, when you see the future ahead of you as finite and uncertain, your focus shifts to the here and now, to everyday pleasures and the people closest to you. Carstensen gave her hypothesis the impenetrable name socio-emotional selectivity theory. The simpler way to say it is that perspective matters. She produced a series of experiments to test the idea. In one, she and her team studied a group of adult men ages 23 to 66. Some of the men were healthy, but some were terminally ill with HIV/AIDS. The subjects were given a deck of cards with descriptions of people they might know, ranging in emotional closeness from family members to the author of a book they'd read, and they were asked to sort the cards according to how they would feel about spending half an hour with them. In general, the younger the subjects were, the less they valued time with people they were emotionally close to, and the more they valued time with people who were potential sources of information or new friendship. However, among the ill, the age differences disappeared. The preferences of a young person with AIDS were the same as those of an old person. Carstensen tried to find holes in her theory. In another experiment, she and her team studied a group of healthy people ages 8 to 93. When they were asked how they would like to spend half an hour of time, the age differences in their preferences were again clear. But when asked simply to imagine they were about to move far away, the age differences again disappeared. The young chose as the old did. Next, the researchers asked them to imagine that a medical breakthrough had been made that would add 20 years to their life. Again, the age differences disappeared, but this time, the old chose as the young did. Cultural differences were not significant either. the findings in a Hong Kong population were identical to an American one. Perspective was all that mattered. As it happened, a year after the team had completed its Hong Kong study, the news came out that political control of the country would be handed over to China. People developed tremendous anxiety about what would happen to them and their families under Chinese rule. The researchers recognized an opportunity and repeated the survey. Sure enough, they found that people had narrowed their social networks to the point that the differences in the goals of young and old vanished. A year after the handover, when the uncertainty had subsided, the team did the survey again. The age differences reappeared. They did the study yet again after the 9/11 attacks in the United States and during the SARS epidemic that spread through Hong Kong in spring 2003, killing 300 people in a matter of weeks. In each case, the results were consistent. When, as the researchers put it, life's fragility is primed, people's goals and motives in their everyday lives shift completely. It's perspective, not age, that matters most. Tolstoy recognized this. As Ivan Ilyich's health fades and he realizes that his time is limited, his ambition and vanity disappear. He simply wants comfort and companionship. But almost no one understands, not his family, his friends, or the stream of eminent physicians whom his wife pays to examine him. Tolstoy saw the chasm of perspective between those who have to contend with life's fragility and those who don't. He grasped the particular anguish of having to bear such knowledge alone. But he saw something else as well. Even when a sense of mortality reorders our desires, these desires are not impossible to satisfy. Although none of Ivan Ilyich's family or friends or doctors grasp his needs, his servant Gerasim does. Gerasim sees that Ivan Ilyich is a suffering, frightened, and lonely man and takes pity on him, aware that someday he himself would share his master's fate. While others avoid Ivan Ilyich, Gerasim talks to him. When Ivan Ilyich finds that the only position that relieves his pain is with his emaciated legs resting on Gerasim's shoulders, Gerasim sits there the entire night to provide comfort. He doesn't mind his role, not even when he has to lift Ilyich to and from the commode and clean up after him. He provides care without calculation or deception, and he doesn't impose any goals beyond what Ivan Ilyich desires. This makes all the difference in Ivan Ilyich's waning life. Gerasim did it all easily, willingly, simply, and with a good nature that touched Ivan Ilyich. Health, strength, and vitality in other people were offensive to him, but Gerasim's strength and vitality did not mortify but soothed him. This simple but profound service